the backdrop of a speakerless House and narrowly dodged and still looming government shutdown and economic woes plaguing the country, wondered why the Commander-in-Chief wasn't talking about the homeless problem or gang violence in the United States or trying to solve the opioid crisis in the US. One entrepreneur was cited as saying, "Why aren't people noticing what's going on around them? We're at war with ourselves." Other voters agreed that the president's appeal for mind-boggling supplementary military aid to Ukraine and Israel was going to be a hard sell. A voter was cited in the media report as saying, "We've got two wars going, everything's screwed up, and we've got to give money to Israel. We've got to give money to Ukraine. We've got to take care of the whole world." Other voters voiced the opinion that Biden's weakness as a president had fed into the war and chaos, and people don't fear us. Many were not at all optimistic about what the future held amid the turmoil in West Asia, coupled with America's internal problems, saying that it's going to get worse. Doug Bando, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute and former special assistant to then US President Ronald Reagan, wrote in a US media report as recent policymaking regarding Ukraine and West Asia conflagration has shown, Washington's war party threatens military action should other states reject the US-constructed so-called rules-based order. He underscored, "Some members of this militaristic machine avidly campaign for war, the bigger the better," pointing out that such warmongers in Washington care little about the lives of others, at least if they're Africans, Arabs, and Asian. He emphasized how the American administration, like in the recent case with Biden's Oval Office address to the nation, positioned almost every fight abroad to be in the country's vital or existential interest. Doug Bando said, "Most of the cases are anything but. Ukraine's collapse would have minimal impact on America's security. Moscow has no reason for war with the United States. There are no territorial disputes between us." Doug Bando stressed, "In Washington, the credibility issue has become the kitchen sink argument for endless war." Doug Bando wrote, "Yes, the conflict might not be in America's interest. It might be consuming good lives after bad interventions. It might be wasting vast amounts of cash. It might have no apparent endpoint after months, years, or even decades of fighting." Bando added, "Stupid and unsustainable commitments that no longer serve its interests need to be abandoned by Washington, allowing it to serve its own people." Doug Bando added, "Young Americans' lives should not be sacrificed to pay for the war party's misdeeds."
Welcome back to Aperture. The illegal recycling of electronics is a toxic business on a global scale. Every year, three quarters of electronic waste from Europe and the U.S. disappears from official recycling system and is shipped illegally to India, China, or Africa. Stay with us as we further investigate to reveal the apparatus of large-scale trafficking, as well as a complex chain of responsibility and collusion in the next part of the program.
The U.S. is the only country in the world, apart from Haiti, that has not ratified the Basel Convention, the international agreement banning the export of toxic waste. To make matters worse, the U.S. government itself is as bad as anyone else when it comes to recycling its own discarded equipment.
The U.S. government is the single biggest producer of electronic waste on the planet.
Discarded electronics of whole departments are routinely put out to public auction instead of being sent to trustworthy recyclers.
Who whoever gives the government the best rate, in other words, they can take it for free or almost for free, the government is kind of obliged to do that, because in our laws you're supposed to go the cheapest way to save the taxpayer money. But the cheapest way is the dirtiest way.
Recyclers who do actually recycle find themselves the target of shady exporters. Plant manager Craig Lorch has been in the business for more than 20 years.
We get regular requests from brokers that are in other countries looking to buy materials, buying computers, metals, laptops, anything with valuable materials in them. We don't sell to them. We don't know what they're going to do with the materials. We don't know where it's going to go.
Craig is part of a minority of conscientious recyclers who collaborate with Jim Puckett and the Basel Action Network. But many U.S. recyclers do export. The Basel Action Network estimates that between 20 and 50 e-waste containers leave U.S. harbors every day. To find out where exactly U.S. e-waste is exported to, Jim came up with a very effective spying technique.
We will just go around to these people calling themselves recyclers, and you drive by them, and the beauty is that you can't hide a big old 40-foot container. So it's very easy to photograph them, and they have prominent numbers, and we take pictures of those and we date them.
Jim then goes online to find out where the e-waste containers are headed.
I can type that number into a database called TrackTrace, and here we see the whole record of that particular container in its last week's voyages. It's gone from Thailand to Singapore, now it's in New Zealand.
Analyzing the main trading routes for U.S. e-waste, Jim made a surprising discovery.
It comes through Hong Kong almost 65% of the time from the U.S. We didn't know that till we started tracking and tracking and tracking. Wow, they're all going to Hong Kong.
Hong Kong Harbor is the third largest port in the world, and any e-waste sent by the U.S. to Asia enters through here. But why isn't it seized and returned straight to sender? ...63,000 containers arrive here every single day on merchant ships of all shapes and sizes. Vincent Wong oversees the customs team at the harbour. The biggest terminal, Kwai Sing, receives nearly 50,000 containers a day. Up to 100 of them are estimated to contain e-waste. Tracking them down is a challenge.
Hong Kong is a free port. That means that the ship and the cargo don't have to declare to customs at the point of entry right away, except they are demanded by customs officers. They only need to declare after 14 days, within 14 days of the import or export of a consignment.
This means that by the time Wong and his colleagues receive the customs declaration, the cargo has usually long moved on. To combat this loophole, the customs inspectors pull out any containers which ring an alarm bell. For instance, because of the company's history or a tip-off from abroad, and submit them to an X-ray scan.
We can scan a container truck in less than 2 minutes, the whole truck. And then, if necessary, we'll open the container for further inspection.
E-waste has its very own shape and look under an X-ray scanner. Items like computer monitors stand out clearly.
For e-waste, we have quite a number of cases in the past few years, and most of them are declared as plastic scrap or metal scrap.
Up to 36,000 e-waste containers are estimated to enter through Hong Kong Harbour every year, enough to fill 20 of the largest cargo ships. About 40 containers a year are intercepted, sent back, and their owners prosecuted.
We do not process each and every container coming or going out of Hong Kong. Around the world, there's no one custom administration that can process 100% of them.
As a result, there are always containers that escape the authorities. Chinese activists are trying to find out what happens to them.
I always want to do something to make some change. So I joined Greenpeace since 2002. The first campaign is working on the e-waste.
Lai Yun is investigating how the e-waste containers slipping through the controls at Hong Kong get to mainland China. Just north of Hong Kong Island in the New Territories, there is a perfect hiding place for e-waste in transit. Lai Yun has come to pick up the trail.
I heard about a lot of e-waste from the overseas, like United States, coming to Hong Kong.
He soon finds a storage yard. The e-waste shipments await transport over the border. And since the storage of e-waste is not illegal, the authorities are turning a blind eye. There are dozens of yards in this area. The site contains everything from TV sets to monitors and computers. If these, as usually claimed on customs declarations, were really exported as usable second-hand goods, they wouldn't be sitting out in the open air in the rain.
I think that China and the United States, so important, work together to solve the e-waste problem. This is an international issue.
From the storage yards, the e-waste is smuggled across the border into mainland China. It's just a few miles away, but it's illegal.
The trucks reload in New Territories and drive across very close, and they have to pay a bribe. It's the only way they could get across. Or you use a small coaster boat and go up the Pearl River Delta into areas like Nanhai. And there, again, you'd pay a bribe to unload it.
Once the e-waste has crossed the border, it travels to places like the town of Guiyu.
When we went to the Guiyu, we don't see any signs to say, okay, this is Guiyu, but we just smell, very strong, the smell. Okay, we know, we arrived at Guiyu.
Guiyu is one of many Chinese towns and villages where illegal e-waste recycling is happening on an industrial scale. No. 80% of the population are involved, processing millions of tons of e-waste a year with the connivance of the industrialized nations. The owners of the yards buy the waste abroad for peanuts, then recycle it using cheap labor. No money is spent treating the toxic leftovers or protecting the workers, so an item can be recycled for a tenth of the cost charged in Europe or the US. As opposed to the African dump sites, in Guiyu, there is a division of labor.
Very typical local family workshop. The workers also recycle the plastic or CRT. This guy used the light to burn the plastic and classify different types.
Separating different kinds of plastic by burning and smelling them is a cheap and effective technique, but it damages the lungs. Another family workshop specializes in recovering minute amounts of gold by dipping motherboards into acid baths. The workers are risking cancer by breathing in the toxic smoke. Afterwards, the remaining acid is simply dumped in the river. The groundwater has also been polluted, and even a simple cup of tea is laced with toxins. The constant exposure to substances such as PCBs, lead and mercury is causing numerous health problems, including nerve and brain damage, skin diseases, and a rise in birth defects.
Really what's happening is people are externalizing costs. You don't want to solve the problem. You'd rather let someone else deal with it, and you'll never have to pay for it. You don't ever get a bill from China saying, you contaminated my land, you have to pay.
China's factories in the neighboring provinces, for instance in Shanghai, Yangzhou, and Guangdong, immediately buy up any recycled materials, such as copper, aluminium, iron, gold, and plastics. But e-waste recycling is not only about selling scrap materials. An even more lucrative business is the recycling of computer chips. In clandestine workshops, transistors, integrated circuits, and other components are taken off discarded motherboards. The harvested parts are sorted and cleaned and sold as brand new components for the production of new electronics. This trade is said to be worth 100 billion euros a year. But it carries a huge risk that has an impact all over the globe, wherever computer chips are a part of our lives. For instance, in trains, planes, cars, nuclear power plants, hospitals, in short, everywhere. The companies who build the control systems for this kind of equipment are finding it increasingly difficult to distinguish between new chips and refurbished ones, and to be sure that their products on which many lives depend are safe. For TQ Systems in Germany, this is a daily challenge. Since the original label has been painted over, it's hard to know which type of chip it really is. Clues pointing to the origin of a chip on the scrap heap are broken and missing pins, or labeling that has been scratched off with a crude and blunt instrument. If the chips were sold as new, they should have come from a factory like this facility in Dresden, where new chips are produced in a highly controlled environment. But the scratched surfaces point to a different origin. Guiyu, or another e-waste recycling village somewhere in the developing world. And this means that the chips might be damaged. Major chip manufacturers have started to employ investigators to keep tabs on the situation.
We're currently investigating a case where a customer had purchased from the open market a power module. They introduced them into a public transportation system, and after 1 month of usage, they exploded.
The module had burnt out inside. Stephen Jetta and his team found out that it had been fraudulently relabeled with a higher temperature resistance, probably because a high resistance fetches a better price.
You can imagine if you have a power module that's originally developed in an environment where maximum voltage is 1200 voltage, and it's been remarked in 2400 voltage, it's not going to last.
TQ Systems have decided to check every single batch of chips on arrival using a special X-ray system. It will take time and effort to find out if the skewed connection is harmless or likely to cause a malfunction. Mike is back in Ghana and observing a steady stream of containers arriving from all over the world. Why do the Ghanaian authorities not seize the e-waste on arrival and only let in the functional second-hand goods? A young Ghanaian investigator, Anas Arameyo, has some answers. Anas always works undercover and has never shown his face in public. He recently took his hidden camera to Tema Harbour, Ghana's main port.
E-waste was one of the biggest areas that we looked into. For example, most fraud happened through the e-waste system. Customs have a form of valuation for such home appliances or goods, and the valuation is next to nothing. Somebody goes to clear used goods from the West, and they will look at it as condemned goods, so you are not going to pay the value that you would pay ordinarily.
At Terma Harbour, no one is really interested in separating working goods from waste. Everything is declared as waste and let in virtually tax-free, with the help of a bribe, or a little present for the customs officers.
Many of my footage, you see the SEPs officers walking through the e-waste. First of all, they themselves start picking some that they think is useful.
Then the importers sell the material. The working items go to the second-hand market, the rest to the scrap dealers. For the buyers, it's a gamble, as up to 90% can be broken or in need of repairs.
There was nothing like anybody's going to check the efficacy. In fact, at the sales point, you are told that this is it. It may have a fault or not. For example, if you take about 30 of them, the ones that will be working well will be about 2 or 3. But then the people who buy also rely on doing some repair work on it.
The items that work or can be repaired go on sale in the streets of Accra.
Majority of Ghanaians, about 90% of Ghanaians, would want to depend on these second-hand equipment. So there are new phones, there are new laptops, but it is still expensive and people don't have the money to afford these things.
The second-hand market is thriving. A functional 10-year-old computer siphoned off the recycling system in Europe or the US trades for 25 euros upwards. But there is a big problem with imported second-hand equipment. Often it has only a very short lifespan left.
We should control not only the waste, but the near end of life equipment, so things that become waste really quickly.
Ghana doesn't have any recycling facilities, so any equipment coming into the country, be it e-waste to be scrapped, new electronics, or second-hand imports, sooner or later ends up on a dump site. Ironically, many of the old appliances will have been officially charged to the recycling system in Europe before being exported. But the ones doing the actual recycling work are a group of kids who eke out a living selling the small amounts of metal they can recover. This can hardly be called efficient recycling. All this raises a seemingly naive question. Given that when we buy a new computer in Europe, its recycling is included in the purchase price, shouldn't this money end up with the person doing the actual recycling, wherever they may be on the planet? If European e-waste continues to go abroad, shouldn't the European recycling system be extended and used to set up modern recycling plants in places like Ghana? Or what about a totally different approach? While harbour controls failed to prevent the e-waste from entering, while broken electronics are traded freely on the internet, while e-waste travels the seas by the container load, while Europe and the US won't stop the ships from leaving, while recycling facilities in Europe are leaking like sieves to shady brokers, we need to remember who is at the start of the e-waste chain. The consumer. Few of us can resist the latest gadgets, and we have got into the habit of constantly replacing them with the latest model after a very short time. Last year, worldwide, nearly 50 million flat panel TV sets were sold, 300 million PCs, and 2 billion mobiles and smartphones. Sales figures for consumer electronics are constantly on the rise, and not only in Europe, but also in emerging markets such as India, China, and Africa. Maybe it's time to redefine our roles as consumers and start using our gadgets for a longer time before the entire planet is littered with discarded appliances that have a long and toxic life ahead of them as e-waste.
Perhaps it's important for the consumers to be aware of how overconsumption and subsequent illegal dumping causes suffering to other human beings across the globe. Perhaps this will lead to more responsible choices, but the bottom line is that governments in the EU and the US must take full responsibility by putting better regulations and systems in place. This toxic tide plaguing the world cannot be stopped while so many governments in the developed world are willing to turn a blind eye. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on November 17th, 2021, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with a number of the academic elite and top scientific talents of the country. Cultural obstacles are the most important obstacles preventing production. The next issue is eliminating obstacles, which I wanted to explain and which is the slogan of this year as well. I have written down that cultural obstacles are more important obstacles to preventing production than problems in operation and material obstacles. This means having a feeling of hopelessness, incapability, boredom, indetermination, having harmful entertainments and feeling there is no future? These are things that truly hamper production. In other words, a young person who can establish a knowledge-based company, do an important part of the work that needs to be done, and by doing so create income for himself and for the country, might resort to harmful hobbies instead of doing hard work. Many individuals become busy with computers and the like. Many of them surf the net day and night or night and day without any purpose and without gaining anything from doing this. Being lazy, lacking determination, and lacking the power to take risks are serious obstacles preventing production.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The need to be strict in the case of knowledge-based companies. Regarding knowledge-based companies, fortunately, they have achieved good growth. Of course, based on statistics, I thought that there are about 6,000 of them. But today, Dr. Sattari, the Vice President for Science and Technology, stated that there are 7,000 of them. Praise God, this is an important achievement and their number should continue to increase. But regarding their number, I think it was in the same meeting that I said that there should be strict regulations for being a knowledge-based organization. It should not be this way that we easily increase their number without paying attention to quality. Being knowledge-based requires certain regulations that should be complied with. Of course, our large industries in the country are not knowledge-based, and this is a big drawback. Experts have told me that these small knowledge-based companies can be effective, and they can also turn the large industries in the country, such as the automobile industry and the like, into knowledge-based organizations. If this is possible, it must be done.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
As the world is watching a genocide unfolding in the Gaza Strip, another massacre is taking place against the Palestinian people in the occupied West Bank. Since the Israeli offensive began on the Gaza Strip on October 7, the violence against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank has also escalated. Israeli forces have killed dozens of Palestinians there. The Israelis have cut off Palestinian villages and cities from one another by closures and settler attacks. That has resulted in a near standstill of commercial activities of Palestinians and their movements. Furthermore, armed settlers backed by regime troops have blocked entrances to most Palestinian villages, towns, and cities through military checkpoints, earth mounds, cement blocks, and iron gates. During the current offensive, the rate of violence practiced by settlers against Palestinians has escalated. That includes preventing them from accessing their lands, attacking them while picking olives, expelling them from their fields, and harassing Palestinian moving on roads.
We used to have problems with the settlers, but after the war in Gaza, they want to kill all of us.
After the war, the situation changed. They started attacking our houses. They didn't used to come to our houses. They started attacking them and the people inside them.
Preventing access to water and food needs, especially in the hurting communities, is done by Israel with the aim of displacing the Palestinian communities in those areas.
We have the same occupation, and we are the same people. Geography does not, you know, divide people. We are just the same. We are all targets. Whenever you are a Palestinian, you are a terrorist, and you should be killed. People are killed for no reason and for nothing. So, you know, this is complete genocide. This is complete war crimes that should be stopped immediately, right now.
Just days ago, Jordan warned against Israel's plans to displace Palestinians living in the occupied West Bank to the Arab Kingdom, saying that Amman would consider the move, quote, a declaration of war. The warning refers to a decades-old plan dating back to before the creation of Israel in 1948. This transfer plan, originally formulated by Zionist militias operating in Palestine and then endorsed by the regime after its creation, calls for mass expulsion of Palestinians to Egypt's Sinai Desert. After Israel's occupation of the West Bank in 1967, the idea of pushing Palestinians towards Jordan became included in the transfer plan.
There's also been a sharp increase in settler violence and takeover of land across the West Bank. Since 7 October, nearly 1,000 Palestinians from at least 15 herding communities have been forced from their homes. In the context of the coercive environment they live in, the displacement of these communities may amount to the forcible transfer of a population, which is a grave breach of the Fourth Geneva Convention.
Before the start of Israel's genocidal war on the Gaza Strip, the occupied West Bank was already witnessing the deadliest year on record for Palestinians. The worsening violence in the West Bank has fueled concerns that the Palestinian territory could become a third front in a wider war, in addition to the regime's northern separation line, where clashes with Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah have taken place. Over the past 4 weeks, Israeli forces have raided Palestinian territories in the occupied West Bank in a bid to quell a rising resistance against the regime there. The Jenin refugee camp in the West Bank has now turned into a hotbed for resistance against Israel. The Jenin camp, with its high population density, narrow space, and adjacent homes, is very similar to the Gaza Strip. Hundreds of Palestinian fighters present a significant challenge to Israel's aim of destroying the military and political capabilities of resistance groups there. Israeli attacks on Jenin and Tulkarm are aimed at ending the resistance in the northern occupied West Bank so that it does not extend to the other cities. The regime has destroyed roads leading to vital institutions and centers that citizens need in their daily lives in those areas. The attacks on the northern West Bank are aimed at ensuring any future arrangements within Israel's vision of expanding settlements. But the October 7th resistance operation against the Israeli regime has proven that the regime cannot protect settlers.
The Israeli occupation policy today is that you need to accept being killed by the Israeli soldiers and the Israeli settlers without speaking. It is a gag order. They don't want the victim to speak up. They don't want the victim to condemn their murder of the victim itself. So that is the policy of the Israeli occupation, colonial, dictator regime.
Israeli forces raid Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, the largest medical complex in the Strip where thousands have taken shelter. The spokesman for the Ministry of Health in Gaza has said that there are only doctors, patients, and displaced people inside Al-Shifa Hospital. Regime troops entered the hospital's emergency department building while tanks surrounded the medical complex. The Israeli military said it is conducting the operation in a cult-specific area. Hamas resistance movement has said that Israel's leaders and the U.S. presidents were fully responsible for the consequences of the regime's raid on Shifa Hospital. Al-Shifa has been denied urgently needed supplies of medicines and fuel. Fuel shortages threaten the function of generators which run vital equipment like ventilators and dialysis machines. The World Health Organization has described the situation of the hospital as dire and perilous. The hospital's last generator has also run out of fuel, which has led to the death of several premature babies and wounded patients.
I am standing here at the ICU at Al-Shifa Medical Complex. This department is suffering after the shutdown of electricity due to lack of fuel. The health ministry warned about the lack of fuel. These people here were denied life support devices. They may lose their lives because there are no support machines or artificial respiration devices. Around 29 patients are facing this tragedy.
Israel alleges that Hamas has built its headquarters in bunkers and tunnels under the Al-Shifa Hospital, a claim rejected by the Palestinian resistance movement and hospital staff. Shifa Hospital has been one of the main targets of Israeli strikes since the regime began its deadly onslaught on Gaza. The situation remains tense in other hospitals as well.
And you are asking doctors and nurses to move people, knowing that that would kill them. And again, why would you need to move them? A hospital should never be under attack. A hospital is a place, a safe haven. This is agreed under international humanitarian law.
The Israeli carnage in the Gaza Strip continues to rack up deaths, especially women and children. But Israel is also impacted by its genocidal war when it comes to its international standing, putting into doubt its legitimacy. Ireland's opposition party has strongly blasted the regime, accusing it of committing barbaric and cowardly war crimes.
The world sees Israeli actions for what they are: barbaric, hateful, cowardly war crimes.
Strong words from the leader of Ireland's opposition party. The Brazilian president relayed his disgust on Israeli crimes when it came to hospitals being targeted.
I'd never heard of children being the preferred victims of a war. The number of women and children who have already died and the number of children who have gone missing is unheard of in any other war.
Hospitals have become a focal point of the war. The Israeli military shared video and photographs showing what it said were weapons stored by Hamas in the basement of a children's hospital in Gaza, where it also said hostages appear to have been held.
And we also found signs that indicate that Hamas held hostages here. This is currently under our investigation, but we also have intelligence that verifies it.
Currently under our investigation is another way of Israel saying that it is not sure. At the same time, it is trying to portray itself as a good Samaritan by delivering fuel to the hospitals. But this amount of fuel is just a drop in the bucket, way too short of what hospitals need. Yet Israel got a boost on its war efforts when the U.S. President Joe Biden said that hospitals in the Gaza Strip must be protected.
Well, I have not been reluctant in expressing my concerns what's going on. And it's my hope and expectation that there will be less intrusive action relative to the hospital.
Biden said he was hoping for less intrusive action by Israel. That was another way of saying that he supported Israel's military operation against the hospitals. The more Israel's genocidal war in the Gaza Strip continues, the more it will come at a cost for Israel and its supporters. The Israeli foreign minister gave his idea of a timeline of when the war may end. He said that Israel has between 2 and 3 weeks left before international pressure intensifies.
Ceasefire now!
Before it intensifies? By many accounts, that threshold has been passed already, evident through the mass worldwide protests. But the real question remains, what are Israel's plans for Palestinians? A host of Israeli officials have made statements recently which reveal what those plans may be. Israeli Minister Smotrich said on X that he supports voluntary migration of Palestinians in Gaza as the right humanitarian solution. Dani Danan, former ambassador to the UN, and Ram Bin Barak, former deputy director of the Mossad, published a commentary in the Wall Street Journal suggesting moving some people of Gaza to nations that will accept them. And the former director of Israel's spy agency, Shin Bet, who is currently serving as the Minister of Agriculture, said that Tel Aviv was rolling out a Nakba in the Gaza Strip. Let's not forget, Israel has denied that a Nakba ever took place. Furthermore, in 2011, Israel enacted a Nakba law that authorized the withdrawal of state funds from organizations that discussed the Nakba.
And An Israeli minister has claimed that dropping a nuclear bomb on the blockaded Gaza Strip is an option. The Israeli Heritage Minister Eliyahu made the remarks in an interview with Radio Kol Barama. Eliyahu also insisted that allowing any humanitarian aid into Gaza was wrong, claiming there is no such thing as uninvolved civilians in Gaza, calling the innocent civilian population in Gaza Nazis. Following the remarks, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu suspended the minister from cabinet meetings. Hamas resistance movement, however, pointed out that Eliyahu's remarks were reflective of the Netanyahu regime's genocidal mindset.
The statement by what is called the Israeli Heritage Minister in the Zionist cabinet that throwing a nuclear weapon on the Gaza Strip is one of the solutions didn't come out of nowhere, but it is an expression on the level of decadence, Nazism and sadism that takes place in the minds of the cabinet of the occupying entity that is based on murder and genocide.
The remarks also drew condemnation from around the Arab world, and Iran called for a swift international response. The United Nations Security Council and the International Atomic Energy Agency must take immediate and uninterrupted action to disarm this barbaric and apartheid regime. Russia has joined a chorus of condemnation that was sparked over controversial remarks made by an Israeli minister about the regime's openness to a nuclear strike in the Gaza Strip. Maria Zakharova, Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman, said that the main issue was that Israel appeared to have admitted that it had nuclear weapons. Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and other Arab states have all denounced the comments. Arab League Secretary General Ahmed Abolteit has said the remarks revealed that Israel possesses nuclear weapons, which is an open secret. He also added that the comments also confirm the truth of the racist view Israelis hold against Palestinians. Since Israel's war began on Gaza on October the 7th, the Israeli military has dropped more than 25,000 tons of explosives on Gaza, equivalent in power to two of the nuclear bombs used on Hiroshima. Euromed Human Rights Monitor has said Israel has admitted to bombing over 12,000 targets in the Gaza Strip, with a record tally of bombs exceeding 10 kilograms of explosives per individual. Israel's use of internationally banned weapons in its attacks on the Gaza Strip has also been documented, especially the use of cluster and phosphorus bombs. The Israeli regime is estimated to possess 200 to 400 nuclear warheads in its arsenal, making it the sole possessor of non-conventional arms in the Middle East and the wider West Asia region. Tel Aviv, however, neither admits nor denies owning the weapons under a policy of deliberate nuclear ambiguity. It has also defied international calls for it to sign the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, the NPT, something that further corroborates its running of an offensive nuclear weapons program. The United Nations General Assembly has already backed a resolution urging the regime to give up its nuclear weapons and join the NPT.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A new report says that almost 95% of the people in Gaza, a territory of more than 2.3 million on the Mediterranean Sea, currently face shortage of drinking water. The report warned the situation could pose serious risks to the health of people in Gaza, as it said that many had already been hard hit by diseases caused by drinking unsafe water from underground sources. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, by cutting off water and other essential supplies, the Zionist regime is subjecting Gaza's whole population to collective punishment. Collective punishment is a war crime under the Fourth Geneva Convention. The Zionist regime hastened to commit that crime since October 7th. Eliciting barely a mumble from powerful governments and institutions, the Israeli government warned a few days later that no one can preach morality to us. Israel Katz, the regime's energy minister, declared that no electrical switch will be turned on, no water pump will be opened, and no fuel truck will enter until the Israeli abductees are returned home. The effects of the Zionist regime's cruelty are painfully evident. Karam, one of almost 1.7 million people in Gaza who have been uprooted, said, "Queuing to get fresh water has become a daily ordeal." Karam's family evacuated their home in Tel Al-Hawa neighborhood of Gaza City. They did so after the Zionist regime instructed everyone living in northern Gaza, including Gaza City, to move southwards. The family has taken shelter in Maghazi refugee camp, central Gaza. They are living in a two-story building with about 50 people, including 10 children. In Karam's new neighborhood, a truck carrying water visits twice a week at most. He said, "At these times, we fill buckets and containers with water regardless of whether it is clean. We give priority to kids, women, the elderly, and people with diseases." Karam added, "For several days, people in Maghazi had to use water that was clearly unhealthy out of sheer desperation." The city of Deir al-Balah is hosting in great numbers people who have fled northern Gaza. It does not have the capacity to meet people's needs. The problems arising from the lack of basic necessities has been exacerbated by how the Zionist regime has caused immense damage to Gaza's civilian infrastructure, including its water infrastructure. Ezzat is among those who have moved from Gaza City to stay with relatives in Deir al-Balah. He said, "There was so little water that using the bathroom became a very difficult task. We had to carry water. If we could find some in a bucket and use it sparingly, we deliberately limit our bathroom visits." Ezzat added, "Maintaining good hygiene is simply impossible. We only bathe the children using minimal amounts of water." After leaving their home, Ezzat and his family returned to Gaza City. They needed to visit Al-Quds Hospital, which has subsequently come under direct Israeli attack and been forced to cease operations. The scene awaiting Ezzat at the hospital was extremely distressing. He said, "Access to clean water was a rarity, and basic hygiene seemed like a distant memory. Hundreds of people were crowded into confined spaces, sharing the same bathrooms." Water pumps were directly destroyed in the Zionist regime's attacks. Previously, Gaza's residents had installed filters in the water pumps. They removed many impurities from the water. Although the water was not suitable for drinking, it could be used for bathing. washing dishes, and performing ablutions before prayers. With the filters no longer operational and pumps either destroyed or barely functioning, the water used in people's homes and places where they're sheltering is often contaminated. The effects of using dirty water are visible. The people's skin has become inflamed, particularly on the parts of the body where they have washed. The 50 other people with whom they are now living have experienced similar effects. The inflammations are similar, though not identical, to mosquito bites. Washing their hair with contaminated water has led to intense itching, especially on the scalp and hands. The health problems within the families have worsened. They have experienced stomach cramps. A 13-year-old boy has an intestinal infection, which is very painful. Seeking medical assistance has become an insurmountable challenge, given that hospitals are overwhelmed caring for the victims of the Zionist regime's bombing. They have tried to contact a nearby doctor, but that proved futile. Calling doctors is now a very difficult task due to the Zionist regime's attacks on communications firms and internet providers. The situation in Gaza is dire on multiple fronts. They are doing their best to protect their health under terrible circumstances. According to Middle East Monitor, there has been a significant rise in the number of cases of skin and respiratory diseases being reported in the besieged and bombardment Gaza Strip. UNRWA spokesperson Kazem Abu Khalaf said recently. Abu Khalaf explained that respiratory diseases usually begin in children, with 55,000 cases of respiratory disease due to overcrowding among displaced persons in UNRWA facilities and hospitals. He added that more than 13,000 cases of skin disease have been recorded due to the shortage of water for cleaning or even drinking water. He pointed out that there has been an increase in cases of diarrhea among children under the age of 5, where the number of cases has risen from October 7th to about 33,000, while only 2,000 cases had been recorded all year until the end of September.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian described the aim of the visit to the Swiss city of Geneva as pursuing the process of delivery of humanitarian aid to Palestinians in Gaza and the end of the Israeli siege of the coastal territory.
We are pursuing process of delivery of humanitarian assistance to people in Gaza. We will have meetings with UN officials and International Red Cross organization. Some of the meetings have been held, while others are on the agenda. Definitely, the humanitarian situation in Gaza is embarrassing.
Amir Abdullahian also censured the U.S. military support for Israel, saying Washington's claims of providing aid to Palestinians are just words without actions.
We have heard from the American foreign minister saying Washington seeks to send around 500 trucks of humanitarian aid to Gaza daily. But currently, between 25 to 40 trucks are only entering Gaza. One-third of this aid is water, lacking the essential food and medicine urgently needed by Palestinians.
The Iranian foreign minister made the remarks following talks with the UN Undersecretary for Human Rights Affairs, Martin Griffiths. During their meeting, Amir Abdullahian stated Hamas resistance movement's preparedness to release Israeli civilians in exchange for the end of the regime's onslaught against Palestinians. Griffiths, for his part, highlighted the importance of this topic and thanked Iran's efforts in preventing the war from spreading. Amir Abdullahian then held talks with Volker Turk, the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. Following that, he met with Mirjana Espoljaric-Egger, president of the International Committee of Red Cross. The talks all revolved around ending the siege on Gaza and the opening of the Rafah border crossing.
For the last 40 days, Israeli warplanes and tanks have been pounding the Gaza Strip. Thousands of civilians, including women and children, have been killed in the Gaza Strip. For the last 40 days, the international community has failed to propose a solution to end the war. Now, many are wondering whether the United